On January 1st, 1963, the bodies of Dr. Gilbert Bogle and Mrs. Margaret Chandler were found on the banks of the Lane Cove River in Sydney, Australia. This case has continued to baffle investigators for more than 55 years because of the circumstances in which the bodies were found and because the cause of death could not be established. Theories ran rife, ranging from Dr. Bogle being targeted because of his knowledge of nuclear weapons to hydrogen sulfide poisoning. But what really happened to Dr. Bogle and Mrs. Chandler? Hello and welcome to Insight. My name is Ali and here with me today is Charlie. How are you?
I'm good. I had a great morning. I spent the morning recording a roundtable discussion with Mo, the host of Targeted Podcast. It's a domestic violence awareness podcast where she tells one story for the whole season and uses academic research to put what happened in context. And Beck, producer of Minds of Madness, and Brooke from The Fall Line were also there, and it was a great conversation. It should be out the same day this episode's coming out, so I definitely recommend everyone go listen. It's called Targeted.
And before we begin today's episode, there is some required reading. Peter Butt released two books and a documentary. For this episode, with some other research, I read his first book, Who Killed Dr. Bogle and Mrs. Chandler? His second book has the same name but with the subtitle The Confession, which I didn't read, but from what I understand, it's a re-release of sorts with additional information. He also made a documentary called Who Killed Dr. Bogle and Mrs. Chandler, which I did watch. I was gifted this documentary, so I don't know if you can watch it for free online, but I will do my best to remember to try and find it and link it on the website and in the Facebook group. Also, as Charlie made reference to in an earlier episode, we don't listen to other podcasts who cover the same topic as this one before we record it because we want to do our own research and have our own opinions, not being influenced by the works of others. But we are both massive fans of Thinking Sideways podcast. I did listen to their episode on Dr. Bogle and Mrs. Chandler many years ago when they covered it, I think back in 2015. But I haven't listened to it since. I do remember being fascinated with the case when I heard that episode. So if you haven't listened to that episode and want their take or maybe a lighter take on the case, we definitely recommend listening to that episode after this one. So now with all that out of the way, let's get into the mysterious deaths of Dr. Bogle and Mrs. Chandler.
Dr. Gilbert Stanley Bogle was a physicist who worked at the Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organization, or the CSIRO, as it's more commonly known. He married teacher Vivian Mary Rich in September of 1950. They would soon welcome two boys into their family in pretty quick succession. Dr. Bogle's field of research centered on the ruby maser, which is a stable state maser. It uses an actual ruby. And a maser, for those who don't know, is a microwave amplifier. This was first developed in 1953, and a ruby maser didn't come out for a few years after that. So we're talking cutting-edge technology. And this technology had a large impact on communication, and also radio astronomy, and also the search for extraterrestrial life, for real. And his work will come up later in the story. However, this wasn't his long-term career path. Dr. Bogle had recently resigned from his job. In a matter of weeks, he and his family were going to head to the United States, where he had accepted a position with the highly regarded science and technology corporation, Bell Laboratories. Mrs. Margaret Olive Chandler was married to Jeffrey Chandler. Jeffrey worked in the same building as Dr. Bogle. Early in their marriage, they had two children. Typical of men in his generation, Mr. Chandler regularly took part in social activities without his wife. But he also had affairs. Unlike most men, he made no secret of it, and he encouraged his wife to also take on lovers. But this didn't mean Mrs. Chandler was okay with it. She eventually became bored being a housewife, being stuck in suburbia where there wasn't much of a social life for her. She would go days without talking to anyone. Meanwhile, her husband was out socializing and she was getting tired of his philandering. This built up until it became what we would recognize today as depression. When she did get together with family and friends, they noticed that she was unhappy. She wasn't her usual bubbly self. She stopped doing her hair and she didn't wear clean clothes. She would even be seen wearing stained clothes, the same stained clothes, many days in succession.
Dr. Bogle, the Chandlers, and several others attended a barbecue just prior to Christmas 1962. On the way home, Mrs. Chandler told her husband that she was attracted to Dr. Bogle. Jeffrey Chandler would later tell the police that he and his wife had a quote-unquote understanding. He told them that he realized that his wife wasn't happy with her life and that he allegedly told her that if she wanted to take on Dr. Bogle as a lover and that would make her happy, then she should go for it. It would also be later claimed by Dr. Chandler that he and his wife had a happy marriage, but he had no problem with her taking on a lover, that their marriage already had a history of affairs that each other knew about, something that Dr. Chandler would later argue had no negative impact on their marriage and only enhanced it. Mrs. Chandler's family and friends would later report a dramatic change in her in the days following the Christmas party, that her demeanour and appearance completely did a 180. This transformation of her appearance and attitude towards her situation seemed to be correlated with meeting Dr. Bogle at the Christmas party and knowing that she would soon see him again. The promise of what could come in her life seemed to give her this new meaning.
Ken and Ruth Nash were also at this Christmas barbecue, and Ken invited the Chandlers to come out to their New Year's Eve party. He also worked at CSIRO with the other men. Mrs. Bogle didn't accompany her husband to that New Year's Eve party. One of their children was sick, and she decided to stay home and take care of the baby. Dr. Bogle left home for the party around 9 p.m., and by all accounts, he was the life of the party. He was moving between groups. He was talking animatedly. He was just really in a happy mood, didn't seem down or tired or losing energy or any of that. The Chandlers arrived at the party around 10:30, so they were rather late. Both Jeffrey and Margaret Chandler went together. Now, Mrs. Chandler was wearing a summer dress that had this rose pattern on it, and it looked pretty, but the other women were dressed more conservatively. Mr. Chandler was underdressed entirely. He even later said he felt uncomfortable because the other men were all in suits, and he was wearing a short-sleeved shirt and sandals, so they were both dressed kind of out of place for the party. Mr. Chandler only stayed at the party for an hour. It was around 11:30 when he left. He told his wife he was going to get some cigarettes, but he actually drove to another party. And it was here that he met up with Pamela Logan, with whom he was having a long-standing affair. Together, they went back to her house where they stayed for about 30 minutes, and then he went back to Nash's party. And this would have been the early morning hours at this point, but he left again after only an hour. Somehow they arranged it for Dr. Bogle to drive Mrs. Chandler home.
The party host, Ken Nash, would later report to police that he found Dr. Bogle and Mrs. Chandler in a romantic embrace in the backyard, that it made him feel uncomfortable, so he turned the porch light off so he and the other partygoers couldn't see the inappropriate makeout session. The two returned inside but then left the party soon after 4 a.m. and drove to the nearby Lane Cove River, which was known at the time as Lover's Lane. Mr. Chandler would head back to Pamela Logan's home, where he would remain until the following morning, and then he would inappropriately take her to pick up his children at his mother-in-law's home and take them all back to the Chandler's residence. At 5 a.m, Mrs. Bogle would awake to realise that her husband hadn't returned home. She wasn't able to go back to sleep and eventually gave in to her worries at around 6:45, and that's when she called Ken and Ruth Nash to see if he was still at their house and or if they knew where he went. They told her not to worry. The party had just finished and he had only just left. Even though later testimony would say that, as we've said, that Dr. Bogle left with Mrs. Chandler almost 3 hours prior to that. What happens next is still unclear more than 55 years later, but several hours later, their bodies were found.
Around 8:30 a.m., two teenagers were searching for golf balls, and they saw Dr. Chandler's body near Fuller's Bridge. They presumed him to be drunk and passed out. This was the day after New Year's Eve. When they returned an hour later, they found that he hadn't moved and his face had turned blue, so they went for help and they got the owner of a nearby cafe, Jeffrey Little, to come have a look. When he followed the boys back, it was obvious to him straight away that the man was dead. The body was face down, but his head was turned to the side. And they could see a bluish-purple discoloration of the skin, and there was blood-stained mucus dried just below his right nostril. There was also a relatively fresh patch of vomit just a few inches away. When police arrived at the scene, they discovered that Dr. Bogle's body was also half undressed. Someone had placed his trousers over the back of his legs in such a way that he appeared to be dressed at first glance, but he wasn't. A rectangular, dirty brown-colored piece of carpet had been laid on top of his back underneath his jacket, which was then laid perfectly on his back. If we ignore the clothing that was placed on his body, he was actually naked from the waist down, excepting his socks and shoes, and they were covered in mud.
It wouldn't be long before investigators found Mrs. Chandler's body, and it was found only a short distance away, around 20 yards or 18 metres away. She was covered with broken up cardboard beer boxes and only her leg was visible. And she was also in a state of undress. Both the rose pattern dress and her slip were gathered up, exposing the naked lower half of her body. The shoulder straps of her dress were down to her waist, as was her bra. Her slip, knees and bare feet were covered in mud. Near her feet were a pair of men's underpants that were covered in muddy water and feces. She was still warm to the touch. Her handbag and purse were missing, but she was also still wearing her wedding ring, so it wasn't an obvious robbery gone wrong situation the police knew they were dealing with. Investigators initially believed that it was possible that she had covered up Dr. Bogle's body first and then her own, but when they looked a little bit closer, there was no way she could have covered up herself in such the way she was, that someone else must have covered up her body as well. In between the two bodies, police would find a pair of ladies' underpants, a man's belt, and a pair of ladies' court shoes. All would later be verified as belonging to the victims. The items were spread out in a distinct line parallel to the riverbank.
The official cause of death was determined to be acute cardiac arrest with associated pulmonary edema. In simple terms, their lungs accumulated fluid, which caused them to stop breathing, and their heart stopped. It's unknown which came first, the heart or the lung issues. It was initially suspected that they both had died from some sort of poisoning. I mean, for one, neither body showed any signs of violence. There were marks on Mrs. Chandler, but they were superficial. There was a slight abrasion to the bridge of her nose, another one to her cheekbone, some more to the tops of her arms. And secondly, at the scene, there were signs of vomit and feces. Later, testing showed that these had come from the two victims. The time of death was estimated to be between 5 and 5:30 a.m. on New Year's Day. The first known sighting of Dr. Bogle's car at the Lane Cove River was around 4:30 a.m., and they couldn't have been there much before. They had just left the party about 30 minutes prior. Based on the timeline, it's assumed they left the party and went straight to the parking lot of the river, and it's unlikely they stopped anywhere else along the way. Careful examination of the clothing they were wearing, and as you'll remember, some was found on the bodies, some was found near the bodies, and some was found strewn along the riverbank. The clothing revealed that Dr. Bogle's apparel seemed to have been removed without any force, and Mrs. Chandler's dress had been removed from her shoulders voluntarily before she entered the depression where her body was ultimately found. There was no evidence to suggest that another person had moved the victims to their final positions. It was suspected that where they were found was where they died.
And as we said, Dr. Bogle could not have placed the clothing on himself in the way he was found, and it was doubtful that Mrs. Chandler did it to him either. But instead, the investigators were convinced that a third person were involved. Not a potential murderer, but someone who covered up their naked bodies with the clothing and the boxes. This case attracted instant publicity. It would be on the front page of every newspaper, morning and evening editions for weeks following the deaths. And it's easy to understand why. Here we have a high society party with alleged wife swapping, an unidentified third person at the crime scene covering up the victims, and the deaths being caused by an unidentified poison. There was also some wild speculation attached because of Dr. Bogle's alleged work with the FBI and the creation of death rays, but as Charlie said earlier, we'll get more to that in theories. The investigators' first priority was to figure out who else was there to see if anyone saw anything unusual. And with all the media publicity, a number of people did come forward. One witness in particular stood out to the police as having questionable motives. 4 days after the deaths, a man named Raymond Challis came forward and said that he had driven along the track where the victims were found and he had seen a man there. Challis was in his mid-30s, he had one arm and worked as a carpenter. He told police that he had been at the Lane Cove River around 4 a.m. and had been in the area for about an hour. While he was in that area at that time of the morning, he said that he liked to collect shrubs for his garden and walk his dog. Although he would then go on to admit that he liked to watch couples being intimate because, as we said, this was a place where people would go to do that. Challis said that he saw Dr. Bogle's Ford Prefect pull up in the parking lot around 4:45. He originally said that he never saw Mrs. Chandler at all, or Dr. Bogle again, or anyone else for that matter. But he then changed his mind again and said that he did see a broad-shouldered, blonde man aged in his 40s jump from the bushes in front of his car and then disappear down the riverbank. At this point, though, the police didn't believe anything he said. But they did follow up on the blonde man but could never find him, and they have gone on record to say that they doubt he even exists.
I agree with that. It doesn't seem like this fits.
I think that he didn't want to be seen as a peeping Tom and thought he would try to deflect attention away.
And he wasn't the only one sending in tips. By the end of April 1963, the police had received over 1,000 lines of investigation from the public, either with information or theories of what they believed happened. They had more than 50 witnesses come forward with what they believed they saw in the general area. The inquest into the deaths commenced in May of 1963, and that did absolutely nothing to resolve this mystery. Personally, I think the inquest was too focused on Dr. Bogle's love life, and That narrowed their focus, kind of giving a bit of tunnel vision to the investigation. A major part of the inquest was to reveal that Dr. Bogle was also involved in relationships with other women, and many of these liaisons took place in parks. I think the insinuation was that we're talking about a jealous husband of one of his mistresses, or maybe even a woman who saw him with another woman. And some of the women who he was in or supposedly in relationships with, they gave evidence. The wife of a coworker of Dr. Bogle's claimed that he was pretty persistent in calling her and asking her out, even when her husband was like right there in the room. Another woman was questioned, and she revealed that Dr. Bogle would give her these hand-drawn maps to entice her to lunchtime rendezvous. So you can imagine the surprise for Mrs. Bogle, the widow here, because allegedly she had no idea that he was having these affairs before this point. The coroner did opt to stand down a key female witness before she could even give her evidence. And this was to protect the families of other women, because a lot of these women we're talking about, they were also married. And those women, even the ones who gave evidence, they weren't named publicly. There was a lot of trying to protect them here while still having them give this evidence and really focus on the women that Dr. Bogle was supposedly having relationships with.
Interestingly, when the party host, Ken Nash, took the stand, he changed his story from what he originally told the police. Remember, in his original statement, Ken said he witnessed Dr. Bogle and Mrs. Chandler passionately embracing in the backyard. But then on the witness stand, he said that he did see them in the backyard, but denied seeing anything beyond a friendliness between the pair. In the end, the coroner, J.J. Looms, he concluded that Dr. Bogle and Mrs. Chandler died because, quote-unquote, because of acute circulatory failure. But as to the circumstances under which this failure was brought about, the evidence does not permit me to say. So in other words, it was much like what the original autopsy determined, that they died either because their heart stopped beating or they stopped breathing. And J.J. Looms also determined the same thing, that it was impossible to determine which came first. The coroner then went on to say that he believed they died around the same time and the only disparity was the way their bodies were covered, that there were no hypodermic needle punches and they weren't strangled because of the lack of injury around their necks. Firstly, there was nothing in the organs of Dr. Bogle and Mrs. Chandler which indicated the presence of any poisonous substance. We just need to take a quick break for a word about one of our sponsors this week, Beta Brand. What can I say about my Beta Brand dress pant yoga pants? I am wearing them today while we record this episode, which was not a coincidence that we have Beta Brand as a sponsor. I've been wearing these pants to death. They come straight in off the line and back to me because they are that comfortable and stylish. I can wear them to work, to the playground, out to lunch, obviously to record, and they go with all my tops in my wardrobe. I needed pants that could take me from the office to running after the kids, and these are the pants that tick every column. They have everything you could ask for in a pair of dress pant yoga pants. They have that dress pant detail so they don't look like your regular yoga pants. They have a faux zipper and pocketing, so there isn't any uncomfortable extra fabric that makes the fitting off. And they have endless choices on their website, so there really is a style for every occasion. Bootleg, straight leg, crop, my favourite leggings, and in all your basic go-to colours. That's why I started wearing Beta Brand's dress pant yoga pants. Visit betabrand.com and use our code INSIGHT to get 20% off yours. Millions of women agree that these are the most comfortable pants you'll ever wear to work. That's betabrand.com, BETABRAND.com, and use our code INSIGHT and get 20% off your dress pant yoga pants.
There are a lot of theories on this case, as happens in unsolved cold cases, so we're going to go through a few of those. There is the theory of some type of double suicide or murder-suicide, and this idea that they had some sort of suicide pact seems pretty unlikely. I mean, they couldn't rule it out early on if they were dealing with some kind of shared psychosis, maybe. But then again, the two only met, as far as we know, one time prior to this night. The area, even though it was popular for suicides for the same reason it's popular as a lover's lane, you know, it's fairly secluded, that came into play here. Then there's this kind of out there idea that the pair had planned a sexual encounter after the party. They had planned it in advance, and Mrs. Chandler gave Dr. Bogle something to, quote-unquote, stimulate sexual activities, and something went wrong. When Mrs. Chandler realized that she had unintentionally overdosed him, she then took the rest of the medication, or whatever it is, herself, and purposely overdosed. Kind of some weird Romeo and Juliet situation, except nobody woke up. This would support the original idea by investigators that she had covered Dr. Bogle up with his clothes before she herself died, but they had ruled that out as a likely scenario anyway. But back to the suicide theory a little bit, we know that Mrs. Chandler was in a depression, that she had just started coming out of it in the weeks leading up to her death. Now, that leads her family and friends to be adamant she wasn't suicidal. But with our current understanding of depression, we know that these upswings can sometimes precede taking one's life. The person feels more energetic because they see an end to their pain, or alternately, the extra energy as their mood is naturally improving, it actually gives them the energy to follow through with suicide plans. But with that said, on the whole, this just doesn't really seem to fit. You know, it's unlikely she was handing some man she barely knew aphrodisiacs. Even if she had taken her own life, she wouldn't have done it partially undressed in a place where anyone could find her with a man she barely knew. While this was an initial theory, it seemed to be discounted pretty quickly for many of these reasons.
Then came the speculation that Dr. Bogle had been taking part in secret research that was connected with the Cold War. First, it was reported in the Mirror newspaper that Dr. Bogle was a world expert in MESA weapons. And as Charlie said before, MESA weapons are devices that produce intense electronic beams. But how or why Dr. Bogle would become a victim of his own creation has never been fully explained in anything I could find. And the CSIRO, where Dr. Bogle worked, strongly denied that he was involved in any type of research that involved the creation of a so-called death ray. This theory was supposedly also tied to Dr. Bogle about to start his tenure with Bell Laboratories in the United States. It got to the point that J. Edgar Hoover was also contacted regarding the secretive FBI nuclear weapons connection here. But all was denied, and honestly, there is nothing substantial here to suggest that he and Mrs. Chandler were taken out either by the government or by his own weapons.
And I'm going to need all of our 4,000 group members to remind me to post an article from Scientific American where they talk about this idea of this death ray, and they tried to make one and they demonstrated it, where basically all it did was admit a heat. It was like a crowd control device, and they first tested it on reporters so they could all report about it. And all it would do is make you feel hot, but it wouldn't do damage, but like an intense heat, so it would hurt. But it was like cold and a little rainy, and water absorbs microwaves. So it actually just made the reporters feel pleasantly warm. It didn't really work. And then the second time it did work, but it's not really useful. And this is 50 years later, right? So this idea that they had some death ray that the U.S. government had that they somehow can't even make reporters uncomfortable with it 50 years later is kind of funny. but I'll post that article because it was really interesting when I was looking up more about these maser guns.
And if you're talking about a weapon that produces heat, you would imagine there'd be some kind of burns to their body if that was the case.
Yeah, the idea behind this is it's not supposed to leave marks, but they also had a hard time getting it to work the first time they tried to demonstrate it. So, you know, I'm not really sold on this secret weapons theory. One of the more popular theories, as we've talked about, is this poisoning theory. And forensics was not a term that was widely used in Australia in the 1960s. It was still in its infancy, but it had proven pretty crucial in another case just 3 years earlier. And this is a case we covered back in episode 41, and that's the murder of Graham Thorne. And if you haven't listened to that episode, go back and listen to it. Especially if you're a forensic nerd like we are, because we talk a lot about forensic botany. But I'm just going to give a refresher. Graham Thorne was a murder kidnapping case where Graham's decomposing body was found wrapped in a rug and dumped in a scrub-covered vacant lot in Sydney. From what was found on the rug, the forensic scientists were able to work out where the boy was killed. It was a house that had pink mortar. There were two types of cypress trees, and there was even a particular breed of dog there. From using all of these pieces and this information, they were able to find the house, and the killer was brought to justice. Besides the limitations in the field of forensics here, murder by poisoning was something investigators weren't experienced with. Statistically, murder by poisoning only accounts for 2% of all the murders in Australia. And that's a number that really hasn't changed over the years. It stayed pretty steady at 2%. The most likely poison was one that was widely available and easily traced, and that's thallium, because it's the main ingredient in rat and ant poisons. While it's easily traced, if you're poisoned by thallium, you wouldn't actually know, really, because you can't taste it or smell it, because it's odorless and tasteless.
And thallium poisoning wasn't something that was unknown in Australia. The most famous thallium poisoner at the time was in 1953, and that was a 63-year-old woman named Carolyn Grills, or Aunt Thally, as she has since been dubbed. She was apprehended and charged with murdering four members of her family after adding the poison to tea, biscuits, and cakes. Aunt Thally would be responsible for four of the 50 murders by thallium in Australia before it was placed on the banned poisons list. The police would keep a running sheet of all the different types of poisons once they ruled them out, and this would soon reach the hundreds. And then they had a separate running sheet for the different ways it could have been administered, like via lipstick, hypodermic needles, even brown jumper ants. The more difficult part was to match up the type of poison with a rational way of delivery and then find a reason why this could have happened, such as murder or murder-suicide, accidental, even a prank gone wrong. One scenario the police did consider for a time was that it wasn't accidental death and that it was something in the food or drink at the party, that the food or drink was contaminated. There is an obvious problem with this theory, though. For one, food poisoning, even that severe, would normally take 12 to 36 hours to show symptoms. Even at a stretch, 6 hours would be the earliest, and that is in very rare cases. The food at the party wasn't served until 2:30 a.m., and Dr. Bogle and Mrs. Chandler were determined to have died 2 to 3 hours later. That's not enough time for food poisoning to take effect. The other problem with this theory is that no one else at the party got sick.
Police investigated hundreds of theories along this poison and drug line, and one of those theories included LSD, and this is going to bring us to the most American theory of all time, MK Ultra. So for those who don't know, the CIA had a program called MK Ultra beginning in 1953. It sounds like the ultimate conspiracy theory, but it actually happened. They were experimenting with mind control, and LSD is one of the drugs they used. The experiments were on everyone from CIA agents to military personnel to sex workers and to institutionalized mental patients. Many of these people did not know or consent to taking the LSD. One of the goals was developing a drug that would work as an ultimate truth serum for use in interrogations, particularly with Soviet spies. Because a lot of U.S. energies went into fighting the Soviets in this time frame. The other goal was to come up with procedures that basically broke people psychologically so you could get the truth out of them. Some of these experiments were nothing short of torture. They were physical and psychological. A number of participants committed suicide, while others wound up in psychiatric wards. As far as the LSD goes, in the end, the CIA researchers realized that the side effects of this drug were too varied and uncontrollable. It made the drug have no real practical use as a truth drug. So, with Dr. Bogle being in a field that worked with things that seemed like from science fiction, like death rays, and then his upcoming relocation to the United States, the thought that MKUltra or LSD was administered to him and Mrs. Chandler came out. Except MKUltra was still pretty hush-hush then, so it wasn't until years later that this theory came out, and it wasn't until 1996 that it was put to the test. Relic tissue was sent to the U.S. and tested using some new forensic techniques. The first pass found the presence of LSD, but they ran a second, more sensitive test with the same equipment, and that one came up negative, that Dr. Bogle and Mrs. Chandler had not used LSD. While it was generally assumed a person could die from an LSD overdose, there were no reported cases anywhere in the world by 1963.
Since then, there has been, though, a death from an LSD overdose did occur in Britain in the late 1980s, so it's not impossible. In this case, a man unfortunately swallowed the drugs and died. The quantity was estimated to be about 400 times a normal dosage, so it's not an easy overdose to happen. Now, the Daily Mail newspaper did speculate that LSD was the cause of the deaths, and there was a claim that a number of the other guests at the Nash party were frequent users of LSD. However, nothing was offered up to substantiate these claims, and police could find no proof that this was the case. Besides, as we said, forensics could find no LSD in the tissue samples of either victim.
The next poison theory is coming to us straight from Peter Butt's 2006 documentary, Who Killed Dr. Bogle and Mrs. Chandler? This is the idea that they were poisoned, but not by anything they ingested or injected, but rather something that was breathed in, a poisonous gas called hydrogen sulfide. So if you've ever been walking in a city and you've walked by a sewer and you've gotten kind of that whiff of rotten eggs, that's the gas we're talking about here, sewer gas. We have to go back to the 1940s for the origin of this story. Throughout the 1940s into the 50s, Lane Cove residents were complaining to the council about this rotten egg smell that was coming from the river. And it wasn't just the smell, though. They were having physical effects. They were getting nauseous. People were complaining they were having breathing issues. And they all thought it was linked to this river and to whatever was creating the smell. And there was also an increase in the number of dead fish people would see floating down the river. And the health of a river can almost always be judged by what lives there and what can't live there. So when the native fish started dying, it was clear there was a massive issue, and an evacuation plan was even being debated while they tried to figure out what was going on. And they got help from the Maritime Services Board. They conducted a complete study of the river, and the study took about a year for them to finish. The issue turned out to be linked back to decades of factory waste being just dumped into the river. And this waste caused the hydrogen sulfide to seep into the river floor, going down about half a meter, and not low quantities throughout that half a meter. I think the word they used was saturated. If the gas stayed trapped in the mud, then no problem to the residents, but clearly it was being released into the air.
We just need to take a quick break for a word about one of our sponsors this week, Purple.
The quality of your sleep affects the quality of your daily life. When I have had a fitful night of sleep, I wake up and I am cranky towards my children. I can't focus on my work. The day just drags on. But when I wake up well rested, I am ready to face the day. I'm just in such a better mood. If you're struggling to get a good night's sleep, try a Purple mattress. Purple started in the medical space, developing pressure-relieving technology that made wheelchairs and medical beds more comfortable for the patients, and they took this technology to create the world's first no-pressure bed in 2016, and the Purple mattress as we know it today was born. The Purple Smart Comfort Grid is scientifically engineered to adapt to any body type or sleeping position. It works by actively cradling your shoulders, your hips, while gently supporting your back for a unique zero-gravity-like feel. There is a 100-night risk-free trial. If you're not fully satisfied, you can return your mattress for a full refund. It's free shippings and returns backed by a 10-year warranty. You are going to love Purple. And right now, our listeners will get a free sheet set and mattress cover with your mattress purchase. Just go to purple.com/insight. That's purple.com/insight. purple.com/insight.
Now, this happened on New Year's, which we need to remember is in the middle of summer for us down here in Australia. But this particular New Year's was pretty cool and there wasn't any breeze to speak of. If gas were building up over the river, they wouldn't have gone very far. And during the search for evidence after the bodies were found, divers had to delay the search because they weren't able to see anything. The black muck from the bottom had been kicked up by the river currents. Over a week later, the visibility in the river was still pretty bad. That's how much of this gas-filled gunk had been displaced not long before the incident. And if you remember those light abrasions on Mrs. Chandler, they don't make a lot of sense. There weren't enough to conclude that she was hit by a person, but they were more the kind that you would get just moving about your day. So what's in between being beaten up and your normal daily clumsiness? Disorientation. If the accumulated gases caused her to be nauseous and dizzy, just trying to get up off the ground could lead to some minor injuries, as I said before, if she fell, got up and then fell down again. Not to mention both of them were only partially dressed. If they had found a little place to sneak off by the mangroves to do whatever they were going to do, no judgment here, but started to feel ill, you'd expect the first thing they would want to do is to get their clothes on so they could leave. But the first thing you would expect them to do is to stop having sex, and it's believed they were because of the semen found on Dr. Bogle's person and on a piece of clothing. So they had time to stop having sex, but possibly from disorientation from the fumes hitting them very quickly, they couldn't also get dressed. But according to a toxicologist on the documentary, the presence of semen and the idea they had time to have sex eliminates the possibility of several other poisons that would have hit them much sooner than that. And if we haven't convinced you yet, let's talk about these mangroves. Where the couple was found was low, like a little low below water level. It was in a depressed area between the riverbank and the mangroves. It was perfect for privacy and perfect for the heavier gases to settle, particularly on this breezeless night. Hydrogen sulfide is heavier than air, in case we forgot to mention that earlier.
And that's not the only important aspect of the location. They were found near Fuller's Bridge, like we said, and just upstream from the bridge was a low dam. From this spot and going out about a quarter mile, these were the worst affected spots with the gas. likely because this is where the largest rapid release of the gas was happening. So we're talking pretty much where Dr. Bogle and Mrs. Chandler were settling in. There was also a claim that the purple discoloration that was seen in the blood of the victims was characteristic of hydrogen sulfide poisoning, and it wasn't something that would have been part of the normal changes you'd expect after death. But we have to address an elephant in the room here. Why didn't anyone else die or even get that seriously ill? The teens who found the bodies, the responding officers, anyone else in the town who's been dealing with these fumes for decades, none of them got this sick and none of them died. To answer that, I think it would come down to the level. And if this theory is accurate, it would have been the perfect storm with the low-lying area, the breezeless night, a sudden outpouring of this gas. When the gas stays below 30 to 50 parts per million, there's no more offense to you than the smell. But if you get 50 and above, that's when we start talking about the symptoms some of the residents were experiencing. Now, once you get to 100 parts per million and up, you don't even smell it anymore because it actually kills your sense of smell pretty much immediately.
So they're in a low-lying area in the worst affected area on a still night where the breeze isn't carrying the heavy gases away. You'd think they would have smelled the gas in areas where it hadn't built up quite as much as they went from the parking lot to the riverbank. But if there was a sudden release of gas when they were already by the riverbank, they might not have. Or maybe they did smell a little as they got closer, but since the river often smelled a bit off, they didn't even worry about it. Then when they suddenly hit an area where it was, say, 150 parts per million, they wouldn't have smelled anything. They wouldn't have felt well and they would have been breathless, but they would have also just come from an all-night party and were about to have sex, so they may not have realized what they were feeling was a warning until it was simply too late.
And I saw an article on the ABC Science website. It kind of took the wind out of my sails on this theory because I was sold on this theory. And police did consider it in 1971 and they dismissed it. But this article, they basically had a toxicologist who said that this probably is what happened and there's no evidence that disputes it. Nothing rules this out. Then they had another who said, no way, this didn't happen, and that the discolored blood could have been from body decomp. And then they had a third who said it was interesting but far-fetched. So they had someone on either side and someone in the middle. But the article, I mean, I was really pretty sold on this kind of freak accident, but that article made it seem less likely. And we're going to have to just go ahead and say, let's say this accidental poisoning wasn't at the root and that somehow this was a murder, and we have some suspects to go over. With any suspicious death, the partners of the deceased and their whereabouts are going to be looked into. And you have to imagine, in the case of two married people who were not married to each other, being found in a state of undress, that leads right to the door of the spouses. Mr. Chandler was considered an early suspect in the deaths because they were being investigated as homicides at this point. He also reportedly didn't show emotion when police informed him of his wife's death. Do we even have to say, after all these episodes, you can't judge someone's innocence or guilt due to their reaction to trauma? But no matter how many times we say it, it is definitely easier said than done. And unfortunately, it did play a role in this investigation. Police believed that a very determined and highly educated killer was likely responsible for the deaths. Someone like a chemist, a doctor, a toxicologist, someone who had the knowledge and experience to use an undetected poison and to administer it to two people without them knowing. It would have to be someone who wouldn't need to resort to something common like rat poison in food. the investigators were pretty sure from the beginning that Mr. Chandler was that man. Also affecting his assumption of innocence was that he wasn't truthful to the investigators. He wasn't forthcoming on some information, such as the affair he was having with Pamela Logan. He made it sound like it was much more of a casual relationship than it actually was. And then there were the rumors. One rumor was that he had a pregnant mistress who was suddenly not pregnant anymore. And then maybe he was leaving his wife or she was leaving him. Basically rumors that made him look like a bad man, and bad men do bad things. Fortunately for both Mr. Chandler and Pamela Logan, Chandler drove a distinct vintage car, and there were eyewitnesses to his car being where he said it was at the times he said in his statement to police. There were three witnesses who contacted police with this information, and one said she had seen Mr. Chandler driving clear on the other side of the city at 4:15 a.m., which excluded the possibility he could have been present at Lane Cove River when his wife and Dr. Bogle had died.
The next suspect isn't someone who the police believed murdered the victims, but follows the investigators' belief that the victims' bodies were covered up by not the killer, but a third person who discovered them and then covered them up for modesty reasons. The prime suspect in this line of thinking was a greyhound trainer, Eddie Bastet, and he didn't come forward on his own and only agreed to questioning once the investigators contacted him after his car was identified at the scene on the morning of the deaths. Bastet admitted to walking the same path daily with his greyhounds, but on that morning, for whatever reason, he chose a different path and didn't see the bodies. At the later coronial inquest, he gave the same story, and that should have been the end of his story here. But it wasn't. Eddie Bastet died in 1976, and when one of his sons were later interviewed, he said that his father told him that he found the bodies 2 hours before the two teenage boys did. This claim was also part of Bastet's obituary. In the interview with Bastet's son, he allegedly said that he always just assumed that his father did cover up the bodies because he was a quote-unquote moralist and didn't like the sight of naked human flesh. To further support that Bastet did cover up the bodies, a woman named Lorraine Blackwood came forward in 2006 and claimed to have lived close to where Dr. Bogle and Mrs. Chandler died. She claimed that a few days after the bodies were discovered, she went exploring some bushland nearby with her younger sister and a neighbourhood boy. It was there that they found Mrs. Chandler's handbag with inside a handkerchief, some makeup, and 2 bottles of white pills that were prescribed to Mrs. Chandler. When they took the bag home, Lorraine's mother, not wanting to get her children into trouble with the police, she threw the bag away. Now, interestingly, Eddie Bastet's nephew lived opposite to where the handbag was found, and Bastet himself only lived a few blocks away. And then in Peter Butt's book, The Confession, he recalls a conversation he had with a retired greyhound racing official, where Bastet admitted to him that he found the bodies and gave details of the crime scene that weren't released to the general public at the time.
Well, I'm not really sure about the veracity of this specifically. I do think it's an interesting thought that someone came across the bodies and covered them. And that actually makes more sense than someone murdered them but then wanted them to be modest, or that they did it themselves, which didn't seem possible. So I do think this is probably pretty likely.
Maybe I'm just thinking from a true crime podcast perspective, but to leave your fingerprints, possibly DNA, at a potential crime scene by covering up the bodies, it's very risky.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I don't know that someone who would come across bodies and their thought was, I should make them modest rather than call the police, may not have really been thinking entirely clear.
But again, this is the 1960s, I guess. There wasn't that forensic thinking going on in people's minds.
That's true. They didn't have CSI or Forensic Files like we watch obsessively, where we're always thinking about forensics.
Exactly.
But I think if we're looking outside of one of the spouses as the murderer, we need to look primarily at the party guests, because they're the ones who knew the two were going off together. And there was one guest in particular that I think we should cover. She's not been named. She's never been considered a suspect, though she was a person of interest early on. And some of the party guests also gave her a bit of the side eye about this. The story is that the woman may have been infatuated with Dr. Bogle. She worked with him, and she was the only person at the party who was single. In Peter Butt's book that we've referenced a couple of times, this woman isn't described in a very flattering way. So I think what we'll just say is that she wasn't considered a traditional beauty, and definitely not as striking as the beautiful Mrs. Chandler or Dr. Bogle's wife. But Dr. Bogle had kind of taken this woman under his wing. He knew she was shy. She didn't get a lot of attention from other people at work. She had some unidentified skin condition that made her self-conscious. And remembering that this was the 1960s, an incredibly sexist time where a woman's worth was really about what she looked like and who she was married to. So basically like today, but fewer people were vocally challenging the idea. Dr. Bogle would pay her compliments, give her attention that may have been flirtatious, may have just been interpreted by her as flirtatious. According to other coworkers, the woman did seem to take this kindness for romantic interest and thought that they were maybe in some type of relationship or they were in the early stages of courtship. She had a degree in science, which would have put her in the realm of what the police of who the police were looking for. And also she had a thorough knowledge of poison specifically.
It is theorized by people at the party that this woman may have seen Mrs. Chandler leave with Dr. Bogle, became jealous, and then followed them to Lover's Lane and killed them both in a spurned lover's rage. There are a bunch of issues with this theory, though. For one, why would she have had the poisons with her at the party, and where would she have got them on such short notice? And secondly, how did she administer this unknown poison to the couple in a way that couldn't be detected in an autopsy? As we know, there were no needle marks or anything to show that she had forcibly poisoned the two. Police did follow up on this line of investigation, though, and they checked on her alibi that she arrived home 30 minutes before Dr. Bogle and Mrs. Chandler left the party. And while this is far-fetched, her involvement being was, and while there is no evidence tying her to the deaths, police could not and have not completely ruled her out as a person of interest to this day.
This is one of those baffling ones, but even with that article kind of making me question the poisonous gas one, it seems like it could have been that, like a freak accident. Except for the fact that this would have been an extremely uncommon way to die and even rare for the area since no one else did, it seems like it kind of checks the boxes of all the parts that don't fit.
I think the legend of this mystery makes it more interesting than what it really is. The wife swapping and the death rays and the strange undetectable poisons. Well, to me, I think the theory of the hydrogen sulfide is what happened, as unexciting as it is. It makes sense to me. We know the area had a problem. The government knew about it. It wasn't a mystery. I think it was an unfortunate incident of being at the wrong place at the wrong time. While the police had no evidence to charge Jeffrey Chandler with the deaths of his wife and Dr. Bogle, the weight of public opinion was against him. He wasn't able to return to a normal life afterwards because of the gossip around him. He did attempt to keep a good relationship with his late wife's family, but they blamed him for her death. Margaret Chandler's parents tried to get him to allow them to adopt their two children, but he stood his ground. Though he never fully recovered from the deaths and the town gossip against him, Mr. Chandler ended up resigning from his role at the CSIRO and took over a publishing company, eventually releasing a book called So You Think I Did It. Following a 9-month illness, Jeffrey Chandler died in August of 2009.
Thank you for listening. You can find us on Facebook at Insight Podcast, Twitter at Insightful Pod, Instagram at Insight Pod, or email us at insightfulpod@gmail.com. You can also support the show at patreon.com/insightpod. And a special thank you to Chesgrave Music for our new custom theme.